Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, I am back from the Savannah Film Festival, and Kevin and I sit down with an exclusive interview with Hoyda Van Hoytema.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 285 of Real Blend, a podcast that talked the golden hour with Hoyda Van Hoytema. Boy, was it exciting. My name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing editor at Cinema Blend and a co-host of the Real Blend podcast. And on this week's show, I am back from the SCAD Savannah Film Festival with a lot of stuff to cover. But most importantly, as referenced, we have an interview with cinematographer Hoyda Van Hoytema, who is Christopher Nolan's current right-hand man, has worked on Interstellar, Dunkirk, Tenet, and the most recent modern masterpiece, Oppenheimer, which Kevin and I slipped into and watched for about 2 hours and confirmed to me, at least, that nothing should beat that film at Best Picture. Like, that thing should get picture director, actor, supporting actor, screenplay.
Which 2 hours did you see? The beginning, the last 2 hours, or like some random three. 2 hours in the middle? Yeah.
So we got in there. What was happening? The scene that we walked in on was him coming home with Emily Blunt and the baby was crying. Yeah. And she was kind of upset. So it was still pretty early on. They hadn't even yet done the Manhattan Project.
That's gotta be the first.
Damon had kind of just shown up. Yeah. Because we did 30 minutes with Hoyda, and then they ushered us into the theater after that. So,
well, after you do the introductions, I want to talk about the behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah, we will. Yeah. We're going to get into all of that.
Yeah.
Well, looking handsome AF, as the kids say. Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hello, Kevin. Yeah, how are you, sir?
Handsome is definitely not a word that I would I've ever thought of considering myself. But thank you for saying that. And good welcome to see you, all three of you guys. So love you guys.
Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hi, Jakey. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Very much accepting my role as a plus one as an audience member on this week's episode, because I didn't go to SCAD. I didn't take part in the interview. I haven't seen any of the movies coming out this week. So I think I'm just going to kick back and go, yeah, this is great. This is great stuff, guys. Well, but I'm excited to hear the story. Like, I kind of know the gist of it being a part of the text thread, but I'm excited to sort of hear what happened. And Daenerys is right here, too. Daenerys wants to hear. You want to hear too?
You're just a pretty face this week.
Really all I got. Dude, that's my life.
Unless you can tell us, can you tell us all about the movie that you just saw today?
I can't.
Dang. Oh.
I was going to try.
Man.
That's why I asked beforehand.
I'm kind of starving for details on that one.
Yeah.
Gabe Kovacs, you said you might see Jake?
Hold on. What's going on there? I might see Jake's pretty face later this week.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah.
It's coming to Chicago.
Coming to Chicago. Okay.
All right. Well, there you go.
Someone's going to take me up on my comfortable fold-out couch.
I am checking my text messages for an invitation, but I don't seem to see one. So,
and that was on purpose.
Apparently you guys have stuff going on. Okay, so let's get into some housekeeping. Of course, if you're watching us on YouTube, hello, thank you so much for joining us. Head down, give us a like and a subscribe. join us here every single week on Friday mornings, or sometimes it's Friday afternoon and evening, depending on where you're listening to us from. We have a global audience, which is incredible to hear. People from Australia and the Philippines and all over that are weighing in and telling us where they've been listening to us. Of course, we're available all different places you get your audio needs met. And if you want to sign up for Roblend Premium, you can get an ad-free version of the show and a newsletter from me every other week. Check the description for wherever you're listening to the show right now for information on how you can do that. Okay, so we want to get into our interview for this week. And as part of the SCAD Savannah Film Festival, which is a festival I've talked about a lot on this show. I go down every year to it. We have been getting some interview opportunities in the last 2 or 3 years, probably, that have been specific to Real Blend. Last year, we had Ron Howard on. 1 year, we had Daniel Kaluuya, who was promoting
Judah and the Black Messiah.
Yes, thank you very much. I was having a hard time remembering that. And then this year, they offered time with Hoyte Van Hoytema. So what was interesting with SCAD this year is that they, in an absence of being able to bring in celebrities, they turned their attention to below the line talent, which I thought was tremendous because it, you know, allowed other people to really take the spotlight. And so they had a screening of Barbie and they honored the production designers. They had a screening of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse or Across the Spider-Verse. And they brought in the three directors who we have had on the show and you guys definitely need to check out. And then they screened Oppenheimer in addition to a lot of new titles that, that played as well, too. But they had a lot of these sort of retrospective screenings. And then they brought in someone like for Oppenheimer, they brought in Hoyte Van Hoytema. And the moment that we got offered that, I had been pestering Kevin and was saying, like, dude, you need to come. Like, yeah. I can handle that interview and even you can feed me questions for it. But like, you have to come to that interview. And so finally, Kevin kind of realized, yeah, I have to be in that interview. And I hopped on a plane and came down. Or the morning of.
The morning of.
Yeah, I booked the flight at 8 o'clock for a 9:30 flight a.m. I do. So we are going to tell a little bit more of the backstory behind this interview on the other side of it. But there's something I do want to set up, which is really interesting. So we're in this movie theater called the Lucas Theater, which is I haven't been to Savannah since I was in high school. I just drove through it when I was in high school on a trip to Florida once. And I remember a buddy of mine was obsessed with SCAD because it's a phenomenal school in terms of the arts. And, you know, Sean and I are just outside the theater hearing like college students talking about sound design. It was just really kind of I was like, this is a place where I would love to just live and walk around and talk about filmmaking all the time. So, I get there and I flew in literally that morning and we'll tell all that on the other side. But the interesting thing about how this interview was set up is we were in a green room in the theater. And what happened was Hoyte was getting an award and then introducing a 35 millimeter screening of Oppenheimer. Not only was it was on film, which was so cool. And so Sean and I are in this like green room. They're getting the audio equipment set up and shout out to the whole team at SCAD for getting that audio set up. They had a really nice setup for us. And we could hear the introduction and the crowd. Like, you would think the Beatles were on stage, like, when they announced Hoyte. It was unbelievable. And what was cool about it was, so he goes up, he does this speech. They showed a little, like, sizzle reel of, like, apparently his movies. We were trying to guess which movies they were based on the audio. And then Hoyte comes in after his getting his award, and he sits down for the interview. And what's cool about it is you could hear Oppenheimer playing behind him. Mm-hmm. So I knew where we were in the movie. So we were interviewing Hoyte while I could hear Oppenheimer in the background playing to this audience on film, while the director of photography is sitting within 3 feet of us, and we're about to break down this movie that I've seen nine times. So this was pretty surreal. And this is somebody that I've been following for a long time. Interstellar was probably the awakening moment for me, but I was a big Wally Pfister fan, and you're going to hear a lot of that in this interview because a lot of people try to compare Wally Pfister and Hoyte because Wally shot Memento from forward through before Interstellar. So this is a really cool thing to get perspective from him and talk about Nope, Her, Let the Right One In. So if you're fan, yeah.
And we talk about the swimming pool scene from Let the Right One In.
So just enjoy this and we'll give a little more like about the backstory behind it. But I just want to set the tone of it. Just know we're in a theater while Oppie's playing, and we could hear it playing while we're talking to the guy who shot it. I just wanted to set that up.
And I want to give people a little heads up that because of the way that we shot it, we do not have video. This was not a traditional junket. So it is an audio only on this one, but absolutely worth the listen. 30 minutes with a master of his field at this point right now, cinematographer Hoyte Van Hoytema, speaking to us on behalf of Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
To have you on the show is really remarkable because I've been following your cinematography for years. We're in the Lucas Theater at the Film Festival here in Savannah. Mm-hmm. You just won an incredible award. Congratulations to you. Thank you for being on our show. Before I get into my first question, there was something I wanted to bring up to you. When I saw the film first in 70mm IMAX, there's a shot that I was curious if I'm projecting this or if I'm just reading into this, let me know. But it's in black and white, and it's right when we're pushing out to go see Einstein by the water, and Oppie's walking out. I think it's from Strauss's point of view at this point in black and white. There's an obstruction in the left corner of the frame, almost like a tree, that I was wondering if am I reading into that or seeing that in the wrong way. I was curious if that was meant to be there from a point of view of like, is it somebody's eyes looking at that moment?
Yeah, that might have been that shot is actually shot through a window. So it's shot from actually Einstein's office. That was the office that Einstein used to occupy in the institute there. But yeah, I, as you rightfully said, the black and white is very much the way we indicated Strauss's point of view in that film.
Yeah. I just remember that it looked like something was in the left corner. I was wondering if that was done on purpose. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it had to feel like a point of view. And so we're shooting through windows, window panes, and there might be some mess left in the junk left in the left side.
No, I loved it. I thought it was cool. It actually made me like, it was more immersive almost. I was looking around the frame a little more. You made a lot of technical advancements in the cinematography that you've done over the years. The day for night tech that you worked on Nope was remarkable. And obviously with 65mm IMAX black and white film here, running the film backwards in Tenet, there's just different technical advances you've made. When you're having a conversation with someone like a Jordan Peele or a Christopher Nolan, and you need to make a technical advancement in order to serve the narrative, how different are those conversations when you're talking to Peele about let's advance day for night or let's 265mm black and white IMAX film with Nolan? How different are those conversations when you're dealing with advancements in technology?
Well, it usually doesn't start with an advancement. It usually starts with an idea, and it can be a very abstract idea, or you know, it can be as simple as going out scouting at night and walking out of a car with Jordan, and we're seeing the mountains around us appearing as our pupils dilate, right? In the night. And we look at each other and really understanding that this is what we want. This is what we want to feel. This is what we want to see. But it's impossible because there's no cameras around that can do that. And so the first reaction and usually the first reaction of any director, right, is like, okay, so that has to be CG or can we light it? And then I say, no, we can't really light it. It's an area that is miles and miles in every direction. So, usually I go home and, something like that just occupies my mind, I can't stop sort of thinking how to solve that problem. And very often, then technical solutions sort of show themselves in answer to sometimes very abstract assignments that you need to fulfill. And it happens the same with Chris, you know, with Tenet, with, you know, what if we can run the IMAX camera backwards? And
what do you mean by run the IMAX camera backwards? Like the film is literally going through backwards and capturing it. Like, how is that?
Yeah. Happening? I mean, the film is literally running backwards through the camera.
And capturing it in reverse.
Capturing it in reverse sometimes.
Oh my God, that's insane.
That's insane. Like, I don't think people realize how, like when the car is flipping in Tenet and we're going forward and that car flips in reverse. Like, is that what's happening there with the film running through?
Yeah. The film is running backwards. You know, when it really got complicated is sometimes we have film running backwards and certain people playing forwards or actually acting backwards to appear forwards later. and then we again reverse the film in the print. You know, there's a there was always a lot of layers of you know, of achieving stuff, like, you know, building cars that had steering wheels in the boots, you know. Mm-hmm. so they actually could drive backwards, but at the same time we would shoot it in reverse so that it actually appeared as cars driving very fast forwards, just because other stuff that we then wanted to see backwards was more complicated. So there was a lot of layers in that film that were very much sort of fun and very hard to crack, you know. It was like a little, you know, every day was like such a brain challenge, you know.
Does Mr. Nolan storyboard?
We kind of don't, you know. The biggest storyboards or the times that we use storyboards were usually on sequences that were technically very, you know, involving for a lot of different departments. So, you know, where visual effects and special effects, you know, et cetera, really needed to do very specific things, then we would storyboard. But for the last two films, we haven't drawn, you know, a frame. However, for instance, for Tenet, we had some sort of a storyboard. Andrew Jackson, our visual effects supervisor, made, for instance, for the car chase, made some sort of a map, you know, moving map of events, kind of a bird's eye view of everything, just to work out where everything was laying in timelines.
Okay.
But you know, how we sort of block or break down a scene or how we make shots, that's something we don't do. That's something we figure out as we're at it.
Wow, that's amazing. I would love for you to talk about the evolution of the IMAX camera. It's something that we try to emphasize to our audiences, going all the way back to Interstellar, of how difficult the cameras were to work at that time. And even getting into Dunkirk, we'd heard a story of an IMAX camera that went down into the water and mm-hmm. you were able to mm-hmm. retrieve the mm-hmm. film footage, versus where you are with Oppenheimer now and even where you hope to see the camera going in the next 5 years. Because mm-hmm. I know that technology is advancing, it seems, pretty rapidly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we are advancing very rapidly around that camera as well. I mean, a camera is a very simple machine mm-hmm. in many ways. It's a motor and it's big film strips that pulls those film strips through the gate mm-hmm. and we expose light on it. So, sort of in principle, it's very simple. In the beginning, IMAX was very much used for vistas and for the kind of documentary shoots where time was not really as crucial as, for instance, on a film set where mm-hmm. you really, you know, you have so many people working there and you have to do a certain amount of shots during a day. Mm-hmm. So the advancements are very much that, you know, that we sort of, the stuff we learned through the years has very much to do with how able is the crew to work with it as mm-hmm. well, you know, mm-hmm. how long are reloads taking and what can we do with our lenses and, you know, how much light do we need has, for instance, a lot to do with the lenses that we then develop. But very much I see the camera very often as a sort of a Formula One car. It's a very specific piece of machinery. Okay. And it's capable of doing things that other machines aren't capable of doing. Mm-hmm. But you have to service it. You have to take care of it. You have to, everybody around it has to be totally in tune with it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to have somebody that can put that camera apart and together and, you know, fix it in a spot, fix it on a beach in Dunkirk or, you know, in Amalfi or whatever, wherever you're shooting, right, on highway in Tallinn. So it's very much the capability of the people around that makes us able to work faster with it and to make it more like a normal, you know, camera that we can use on a feature film.
Okay, okay.
You know, my take has always been like, you know, you have complicated technology, but for me as a cinematographer and as well as my crew, our job is to make that technology or is actually to wrangle or control that technology, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want to make it ourselves easy, or we don't want to be comfortable. We want to work with we want to be able to work with the best equipment in order to create the best possible cinematic experience for the viewer. And sometimes it means that we have to go through trouble and through pain, and, you know, we gladly take it because we love it. You know,
it's amazing.
And I've said this before on our show, the moment cinematic immersion changed for me was the moment I saw Wally Pfister and what Nolan did on The Dark Knight, watching, you know, Jim in that 18 wheeler, just flipping. Jim Wheeler. And it's just one of those, like, was one of those moments that I just remember my jaw dropping. And then I go, and then Wally obviously continues on, and then you jump in with Interstellar and Tenet and Dunkirk. And
I mean, Chris and Wally on The Dark Knight, I mean, they were the true pioneers, because they literally, you know, blew dust off a camera that was previously only used for like
planet
documentaries.
Sure,
and
sure.
They had to adapt it, and they had to have the sort of the guts to take that on a film set and actually expose film on it, et cetera, et cetera. So when I came in on Interstellar, you know, Chris had already done it once, and he was like, you know, he was already kind of like an expert on it. You know, he was telling me kind of what would work and what wouldn't work, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But he really, you know, awoken in me this will to totally control and wrangle that piece of equipment.
Oh, that's amazing.
Shout out to Jim Wilkie, by the way, for people who are listening to this.
Oh,
he was in the 18 wheeler when it flipped. He was in the plane in Tenet when the plane went into there. I'm going to jump back from a non IMAX shot of yours, because one of the things that I love about the filmmaking that you and Mr. Nolan do is, especially with Oppenheimer, you're dealing with a concept that is intimate yet epic at the same time. And you have these massive IMAX shots of just Killian's face. Mm. And as we're watching it, we feel so intimately connected. Mm. But going back to a shot in Interstellar, I know everyone talks about the McConaughey sequence when he's watching the footage of his kids growing up over all that time. But I have always heard stories about that scene that McConaughey did not watch that footage prior to that shot. Nolan wanted him to kind of see it in that moment. I'm wondering your memory of that day behind that camera as that the sun, whatever sunlight you're using, as it's spinning around and like hitting his face every cycle. Mm-hmm. But behind that camera emotionally, I know you're doing a job, but do you feel that as you're watching McConaughey do that performance? And what's your memory of being behind the camera on that shot? Because it's become like one of the most iconic moments in cinema.
I mean, one of the rewarding things of this job is, you know, as a cinematographer, as a camera operator, as somebody that looks through the viewfinder on a film that essentially doesn't have any, you know, video assists, it's kind of the next best way of watching it, right? Through the camera, because the best way is to sit next to the camera and be in the moment, which is very much what Chris does. He's a kind of director that trusts the technology, but sits close to the camera and has this the most intimate connection with whatever happens in front of the camera. But to look through a viewfinder and to watch the scene, of course you're always reading the frame for its, you know, technical inconsistencies or et cetera. But when a shot really works, when it really comes together, and that's light, but mostly I think acting, you know, or performance, when everything falls into place like a puzzle, I mean, there's in a way nothing more beautiful, you know. Very often, you know, you have to sort of shake yourself and tell yourself, this is happening. This is actually happening in front of you. And it's your privilege to film this. And so I'm very humble towards sort of the subject matter and towards the concept that once in a while, you know, some magic seeps onto the celluloid, you know.
And it could be day 50 of like 83 or something.
Yeah. And you know, also this kind of things happen very often when you have like kind of shitty days, you know, or like when stuff doesn't really work out.
Yeah.
And you're getting into over hours or the sun is setting a little too fast. It's like very often at the end of the day, you know, you're stressing because you know that things are getting dark and the sun is going out and you have so little time left. And so towards the end of the day, you speed up and you start to build up a little bit more adrenaline, you know, and everybody starts to work a little faster in order to get it in there before the sun sets. Mm-hmm. And very often when that energy level is sort of going up across the board, you know, that's very often when very good things happen as well. Mm-hmm. You know, the best things you very often shoot towards the end of the day, you know, when when everybody's energy is up, the sort of the after lunch blues, which always it takes everybody, including myself, to recover a little bit after lunch. And then when you start speeding up, you know, sometimes you're just flying and beautiful things happen.
That's amazing. There's a scene in Oppenheimer I would like to get your take on. And it's the speech that Killian gives that plays with the manipulation of sound. It's dropping out. We're hearing the foot stomps. And there's specific imagery that you have to capture in order for that to have its impact, to have the full impact of that scene. It's a scene I will never forget. Can you just talk about how much you're aware of what the sound is going to do so that it matches your imagery in a sequence like that?
I mean, you know, Chris is very often sharing very much his ideas about what he wants to do with it, and a lot of that is part of his writing. His writing is very sort of concise but precise. Mm. You know, cues that are going to be very crucial to how it's going to work in its entity. He, you know, these descriptions, these cues are always there. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff in his head, of course, that are always a surprise when you watch the film later. Mm. He's one of the few directors from which you can watch the film afterwards when it's finished and you realize, oh, this is better than I imagined it, you know?
Right.
Very often, you know, as a DP, you rewatch a film and you have imagined it yourself, and it's not as good as you imagined it. It's okay, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But with Chris, he always hits you with that surprise. You know, it always turns out beyond my own imagination.
Sure.
I'm assuming you had a screen behind Killian on that shot when it starts shaking, and then also even in like the gray room sequence when Clark is really reeling at him. Like, are there not
a screen, but we came up with this this funny idea in which we actually are projecting the actual wall that you're seeing onto the wall. So and then Andrew Jackson is you know, feeding algorithms to that image so that it's scintillating, shaking. So all these vibration effects, they were all done in camera.
Wow. Interstellar, they were projecting out of the windows of the ship, right? Yeah. Like there was no green screen.
Yeah.
There's a book that I just finished by Sidney Lumet called Making Movies. And it's probably one of the most incredible books I've ever read about the choices a filmmaker makes. And he talks about 12 Angry Men, and he talks about this great scene in 12 Angry Men that throughout the film, he changes the lenses to get more and more claustrophobic as the film goes on.
Yeah.
And when I'm watching the Casey Affleck scene, the interrogation scene that he has with Oppie, I've seen it multiple times now. So I watch how you start that scene. We're wide in the room. And then as the scene goes more and more intense, we get closer and closer on Casey Affleck's face and Killian's face as we're kind of seeing the manipulation. Is that a similar situation? Are you changing the lenses to get more claustrophobic there? Or is that just pushing in?
Well, we have one lens that we refer to as a little bit as the paranoia lens. You know, it's a lens that was just a little too wide. Mm. You know, it's the paranoia lens because it's so wide, yet it can go very close. So you very obviously invade somebody's private space. Right. You know, as a watcher, you can really understand the proximity of a camera. So it's a very intimidating way of showing somebody's face, and of course that has a very strong effect when you're in the room as well, in sort of an interrogation situation. Mm. You know, everything within reason and everything with its own subtlety. But since this was a film which was very much about close-ups, we were very aware of, you know, the proximity of the camera to the actors, for instance.
Yeah. I love when you follow Robert Downey Jr. into that room and he just removes the scarf so beautifully and just kind of just the way the camera was always, it was, you're so right about the proximity. It was interesting.
Well, and in that way, I mean, that was something that Chris and I spoke about a lot, in not from the beginning. You know, this film, more than any other film we did, it wanted to really feel very subjective, you know, especially since it's sort of constructed out of these two perspectives, like Strauss and Oppenheimer. Mm. Where else, we really wanted to be in Oppenheimer's head. Mm. You know, we really wanted to sort of go to his face, get through it, turn around and look through his eyes into the world, you know.
Yeah,
that's helpful. Or stay outside and look at his eyes, but then project whatever he sees into his, let us project into his face what we want, what we needed to see. So we knew that it was going to be about that kind of intimacy and that kind of subjectivity.
Mm. I love coming to the SCAD Savannah Film Festival and getting to see artists like you interact with the students. I know how valuable that time is to them, to be able to pick the brains of people who are in the industry and doing it. And I'm sure that they hit you with incredible questions about your work.
They have.
What I'd love to know, though, is you, when you were their age, or when was it when you saw a shot that you had to know how it was done? Can you remember a shot that you saw that maybe put you on this path, similar to the way that these students are like, where it actually made you think of the work that went into pulling that shot off?
Yeah. I mean, funnily enough, it was for me, not so much about pulling off shots, you know, it was much more, I just remember very well that, you know, how a camera can create strong moods, you know, and where I understood that photography was such a big part of how you experience a film or how you get pulled through a story. And I just remember a retrospect of Nicholas Roque on television when I was, I must have been 12 or something, you know, 12, 13. And there was a bunch of Nicholas Roque films, you know, there was Eureka, there was, you know, Don't Look Now, was it Track 29? Or it was like Insignificance was there. Mm. It was a bunch of Nicholas Roque films, and they're very, very specifically, meticulously photographed film, because Nick Roque, he used to be a cinematographer himself as well. So he had a very meticulous, a very specific, you know, visual language. Mm-hmm. And I just remembered that I got aware of that a camera is actually doing things that has influence on a story, mm-hmm. or how you experience a story. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of maybe even too young, you know, or I definitely was too young to really understand what these films were about. But I remember them very well. Mm-hmm. So I rewatched them later, of course, you know. And I still think that they're interesting and brilliant, you know, but we
point out so many times on this show that a film doesn't change at all, but you change.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Know? So you watch it at a certain age, it meant something to you, and then later it could mean something completely different.
Absolutely. But I would definitely argue that seeing those ones that young definitely turned me on to, or made me aware of cinematography.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I have to tell you, to have you on our show is such a big deal because I've been following your work for so many years. I think you're my favorite director of photography working today. I mean, I love Richardson, I love Prieto, I love all those guys and Chivo, but you just the way you operate, it makes me want to go to the movies and live these films as events. Like I saw Dunkirk 6 times in 70mm IMAX, obviously Tenet, I saw multiple times, even though during the pandemic, but to have you here is wild. And I was thinking about the movies you've made so far with Mr. Nolan, and you think about the first two you made, scored by Hans Zimmer. Mm. Second two you make, scored by the incredible Ludwig, who's his music for Oppenheimer. Mm. I listened to that on vinyl. It's one of the greatest scores I've ever heard. But you, as the cinematographer, when you sit down and you finally see your images set to music, I have to imagine that's an emotional experience for you when you finally see it all come together. Mm. Is there a difference in how you felt with Zimmer's music attached to your visuals than it did with Ludwig's music attached to your visuals? And they're very different musicians, but what's that experience for you emotionally when you see that set to your music, set to your...
Let me start by saying thank you. I can say thank you, but I also have to add to this, of course, one thing that I loved from the start from working with Chris is that Chris is so much committed to the cinematic experience. And, you know, he's all in for, you know, the movies as an event, you know, and he from the start, he's always, you know, laboring and beating himself over to, you know, create experiences for people that are, you know, that are magic and that are, you know, that feel big and definitely feel like things that are, you know, that are not possible to experience anywhere else than in a theater, you know. So he's super much committed and he's like tirelessly working and slaving for years. And then when I started joining him very much into that quest, you know, with, you know, beating ourselves up over what kind of cameras we shoot on and the technology we use. And, you know, it's very often mistaken that it feels like it's a luxurious or it's a smug thing that we shoot on the big format. But for Chris and for myself, it is like, it's like 100% commitment to the experience in the audio, the experience for the audience in the cinema. And so, you know, I think with Dunkirk, you know, we haven't done any less. And I love Zimmer. I love Ludwig. I think, you know, I'm always very sensitive to when I get compared, for instance, to Wally. I mean, we're very different human beings. Yeah. And, you know, we vibe with different things. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing with Chris is that I have the feeling that he is very much interested in, you know, the personal takes of his collaborators, you know. Mm-hmm. So from the beginning he has never sort of expected from me to be Wally or to be similar to Wally. I think that Chris has always done his thing and he has never sort of diverted from that, but then has invited me sort of to add my personality to the whole thing. Mm. And in that way, he's been doing the same with Ludwig, you know. Mm. He makes different music than Hans. And it's very refreshing to hear new sounds, you know, new soundscapes. It's very refreshing to see Ludwig coming up with new cues or, you know, it's very different. And in that way, every single film is so different and also needs to be different. You know, every film has its own right of existence, I would say.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I hope that kind of answers that question. But
it's just great to hear. Yeah.
Well, I know we're running out of time. I'll get you in here on this one. Matt Damon was doing press for Oppenheimer and he was talking about how he had told his wife he was going to take a break, you know, and he'd be at home. But on the one caveat was that if Mr. Nolan called, do you have something similar in place? Are you, whenever, no matter what's going on, when Chris calls, are you ready to jump?
Yeah, and I take a whole a lot of caution and time. You know, when Chris is about to start something, I will not recklessly just jump into a project before I know what he's doing, because you know, there's something when you have done like four films together, like we have now, you learn so much on each and every film, and what you learn, you also carry with you on the next project. Mm. So in a way, you get a shorthand, and at some things you just get better, and somehow it's so much easier to struggle through the, you know, through the white noise or the, you know, you know, the things that don't matter. And when you have been at places together, you know, you can just go straight to the point, and you can, you know, filmmaking becomes a purer and purer experience every next consecutive film. Right. So, it's for me, it's very clear that I want to hold out for whenever Chris comes with something new.
I just want to end by saying this. We talk about a lot of Nolan movies. Your cinematography on Her, which I always found amazing that Spike wanted to shoot futuristic LA with Shanghai, which is why I went to Shanghai for the first time. Your work with The Fighter is brilliant. I can't get out of here without mentioning the pool scene and Let the Right One In. We that was the first time I saw your work. Mm. And before we let you go, you still think about that at all when you're making these, when making other films? Because that scene, I've never seen anything like that before in my life. And I loved what Matt Reeves did with the remake, but the original was just, it was just amazing.
No, I appreciate it. You know, that film's regularly comes back, you know, it's somehow, for whatever reason, that film vibed a lot with people, and it resonated a lot. And I also, I still love that film for so many reasons. What that film did for me very much is, you know, we were very meticulous with creating oneers. You know, the just the whole idea that when you approach a scene, you know, to ask yourself, what would you do if you only had one shot in order to create the scene? Mm-hmm. And by doing that, it forced us sort of to really unlock the scene to ourselves, right? Mm. Because, you know, you have to be aware of rhythm. You have to be aware of tension. You have to, you know, you have to know when you want the close-up and when you want to have the wide shot. So and you start moving the camera. So that's how we very much build up every scene in that film. And up until today, sort of that method of, you know, wanting to do things in a oneer, living in a reality where, you, of course, you very often divert from it, but just purely that ambition still helps me a lot today in how I approach films. And you talk about the pool scene, but that was in the book. That was a very sort of widely described and very involved action sequence that Thomas and I then decided to do in one shot. But that came in a way from that principle, you know.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, they are pulling you out. They're saying you
I flew here today for this, and I'm flying home right after this.
Thank you. That's such an honor.
Well, to have you.
Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you coming on. Thank you so much.
We want to thank specifically our friends at the SCAD Savannah Film Festival, our friends at Universal Pictures, of course, for coming out, and then Hoyda Van Hoytema for taking the time to sit down and talk with us. And hopefully you guys realized something that I really took away from it was that it was just an incredibly casual conversation. Yeah. He just, you know, plopped down in the chair and sat across from us on a couch, and we were able to sort of break down, starting with Oppenheimer and then really feeding into. And Kev, I don't know if you got this sense, like, I didn't want to keep bringing up Nolan in our questions, right? Yeah. I wanted him to sort of stand alone as the work that he does necessarily. Yeah. And when we got into other films that he did outside of Nolan's sphere, I was really happy about that. But he kept bringing up Christopher Nolan. You know, he kept name dropping Chris, which I know freaks you out. Yeah,
it's weird. I can't call him Chris. And it's weird hearing somebody call him Chris. I just don't. it just doesn't operate in my mind that way.
But they're so symbiotic at this point. Like their working relationship is so in tune. And that was one of the things, you know, to hear him talk about that and to give us more insight into the way, like whether he storyboards and, you know, to get some insight into like a hearing him break down the work that went into the scene with the crowd, you know, chanting and stomping their feet and the audio dropping in and out and them knowing what they were going to do in order to match the visuals of that was incredible. But I got the sense that he hadn't really told a bunch of those stories, that he hadn't really been asked, you know, questions about those specific scenes from the angles that we were going after. So I was really happy with the way that it went.
Yeah. And you know, as we were saying before this started, I mean, I flew in that morning and then flew home that night. So this interview was a huge deal for our show. But on a personal level, I have Hoyta's film strips all over my apartment. I have Dunkirk film strip, 70 millimeter IMAX. I have, you know, Interstellar 70 millimeter IMAX. I've seen his movies multiple times in theaters. And then you think about the filmography itself. I mean, to be able to tell him, because I mean, I went to Shanghai, China, just because of her and the decision that Spike Jonze and Hoyta had in terms of shooting futuristic Los Angeles in Shanghai to make it look like it was decades in the future or whatever it was. These are all like interesting decisions that are conversations that happen between a filmmaker and their director of photography, which is interesting in terms of the first question about the day for night stuff with Peele and the different conversations he has with different filmmakers when technical advances are changing on the fly like that. What blew my mind, it was so funny because like he just like kind of like just says like nonchalantly, yeah, we just ran the film backwards to get those scenes in Tenet. Like, and I think I was just like, what do you mean by that? He goes, literally, we ran it backwards. I'm like, I don't understand what that means. Like having film go through a camera backwards, because for people who, you know, have heard our show, a lot of those backward scenes in Tenet are not rewound. Those are shot that way. Either the actors are acting backwards and or they're feeding the film backwards to create a backwards shot.
When you talked so about funny, like the way that they put a driver's seat in the back of the car so that that car can be driven in reverse, essentially, but the driver's moving forward. Like, I almost got the sense that he doesn't quite know how Tenet was filmed.
Dude, what's interesting is the first time we ever
Tenet has to be like whenever you're in like trigonometry and you study and you learn how to do all the equations and then you do the test and then 6 months later you're like, I don't remember how I did the test. Yeah. I aced the test, but I don't remember how I aced the test. Well,
First time we ever had Christopher Nolan on the show was, which it sounds crazy to even say that out loud, but with him and John David for Tenet, I tried to ask Nolan, why is there a rapping us about that scene where the car is flipping back or backwards and we ran out of time. And I still had no idea how they did it. And I finally got to ask Hoyta about it, which was cool. This was really surreal. I mean, I do want to shout out his other work. His work with James Gray on Ad Astra is remarkable. He's just the fighter, David O. Russell. He shot the hell out of the fighter. He's just a director of photography who's his language of film and camera work is just speaks to me on a level that I can't comprehend. And people always think I'm insane when I say I see these movies 6, 7, 8 times. And I'm sitting in the theater with Sean. So right after the interview was over, the cool thing about it was that the person from SCAD walked us to these two reserved seats in the theater to watch the film on 35 mil. And everything that we had just asked him was coming up. To have asked him about the Casey Affleck scene was so cool. And for people who haven't seen Oppenheimer, or if you have seen Oppenheimer, there's this really great intense sequence between Oppenheimer and Colonel Pash, who's played by Casey Affleck. And it's just a simple dialogue sequence. But the way that he lends that, he called it a paranoia lens in the interview, as you heard, you know, you don't think about this stuff when you're watching the movie because you're subconsciously taking it in. When he's speaking a language, as you go closer and closer and closer and closer on Affleck's face or Killian's face, like you're not aware that the camera or the lens may have shifted, but you are aware that you are feeling a lot more paranoid and intense in that moment. And I think that's the beauty of film language. And then to hear him open up a little bit about watching his visuals connect to Ludwig's scores and Hans's scores. It was cool. And Sean and I talked about this afterwards. It was kind of interesting to hear him talk openly about the Wally Pfister thing, because for people who aren't aware of this, Wally Pfister, as I mentioned, he was Nolan's guy, man. And I mean, Dark Knight, you know, it was revolutionary. So even Hoyta said that he had to learn what the IMAX camera could do from Nolan, you know what I mean? Because of the work he did with Wally on Dark Knight. But I think a lot of people out there on the internet want to pit them against each other. It's like, why did he shift from Wally? Because Wally ended up directing a movie called Transcendence. That's why he ended up going his own way. And I think that's when Hoyta dropped in to do or start to work on Interstellar. And so that time frame is really interesting if you think about it. But shout out to Wally Pfister, an incredible DP, obviously, and Hoyta for being so awesome to us. And yeah, that was truly an experience that I'm just happy I got to meet the guy. Honestly,
I was so glad that you came. Yeah. Honestly, I was so happy that you came. And it was really annoying because while we watched Oppenheimer, after that bit, whenever a scene came up that we had broken down with Hoyta, Kevin and I leaned over to each other and we said, Hoyta just told us about this.
Yeah, it was like the Chris Farley thing. Right? Like, you remember this time? Like, we literally were like, it was wild. Like there's a lot of these experiences that I can't, it's hard to explain emotionally what this stuff means to us. But to sit in a theater watching it on film after he discussed it is pretty wild.
That was surreal. That was really surreal.
And he was so nice to us and he was so cool about it. And yeah, thank you so much for being on our show, Mr. Hoytema. You're awesome.
Jake, maybe next year you'll come down and join us at the Savannah Film Festival. It's
beautiful. I got to tell you, walking around that area, I felt like this is where I should be.
Should we do a real blend takeover of SCAD next year?
Yes, I'm down.
You know, really invade SCAD.
Like we could have done something with like Hoyta and then a Q&A or whatever we could have done of some sort. So anyways, thank you. And if you missed our Christopher Nolan interview for Oppenheimer, just go back into our archives.
I call him by his middle name. I don't know about you guys, but
call him Chrissy Poo.
That's the terms. Yeah. That we're on. Nolan's middle name? If you're watching this on YouTube, I've dropped the Nolan interview at somewhere in there, but I've also dropped, because you mentioned James Gray, one of our all-time great interviews.
Cool.
One of our all-time great interviews,
James Gray. With his recipe for sauce.
Yes.
By the way, I don't know if you guys know this, but Jake Hamilton and Christopher Nolan share the same middle name.
Do they really?
Christopher... Really? Now I'm afraid. Well, now I'm afraid to like say because I don't know what we put out on the internet. Oh, I think everybody already knows.
You guys share a social security number too, Jake. Go ahead.
Jake, you did a whole bit. I was saying Twilight a whole cast. Bit.
Yeah, Christopher Edward Nolan.
Oh, Edward.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. I was just about to be protective of my middle name, and I was like, I did a whole bit with the Twilight cast. Like, I can't be protective of my middle name now.
It was brilliant, Jacob and Edward, and he would sit down.
It was the result of being 18 Twilight movies in and going, I've got no. No questions left for any of you.
Wait till it comes back around. Like the Hunger Games is coming back around.
Yes, it is.
Interestingly, yeah. There's more material for all these different things. All right. So I just want to briefly give you guys a rundown of what I got to see at SCAD. In addition to doing Hoyta Van Hoytema, they had an incredible lineup this year. They showed Maestro and Saltburn, and they were going to have Rustin and The Holdovers and Priscilla, and they're closing with Ava DuVernay's Origin. I had to come back early in order to do a couple of interviews here from the house. I just wanted them to go really well. I had a couple of really important interviews, but I was able to see. So they opened with Naiad, which is the Netflix film that's going to be coming out with Annette Bening and Jodie Foster. I was lucky enough to see that before I went down there. Sunday night, they had another film. Oh, American Fiction, which I was able to see that up in Toronto. That's making the rounds.
Who directed American Fiction?
That is Cord Jefferson, I believe, is his last name. And then that film also just won the Audience Award at the Middleburg Film Festival in Virginia. So people are talking about Jeffrey Wright potentially getting in for Best Actor for his performance in American Fiction, and that film potentially vying for a Best Picture award. What I did manage to see was Todd Haynes's May-December, which I can tell you is a Todd Haynes film. So take that for what you wanted to believe. I think Todd Haynes makes kind of dramatic soap opera type films. Mm-hmm. And this very much plays to that tone. It's a great, great setup for a movie.
I didn't realize what it was about until I recently saw the trailer. And then I went, really? That's what this movie's about. I had no idea.
Yeah. So for people who might not know, Julianne Moore's character was at one point a 36-year-old woman who had an affair with a seventh grader. I don't know how familiar the name Mary Kay Letourneau is, but that was a very famous teacher that had an affair with one of her elementary school students. This is a real thing that happened. And then, of course, this woman became a tabloid.
You said seventh grade?
In the movie, it's a seventh grader. Yes.
That's middle school.
Yes, that would be middle school.
All right, just to clarify.
What did I say?
You said elementary.
Elementary to me is K through eight. Because my elementary school was K through eight. I didn't have a separate middle school.
Mine was, six, seven, eight was middle for me. That's weird.
Yeah, I went to a bunch of different middle schools, and I went to ones that were seven, eight, and then ones that were fifth through eight, where they called middle school. So that's, I think it's just weird. I don't know why, but.
Well, I was in a one room schoolhouse in the middle of the desert.
And, what was school like on the prairie, Sean?
Yeah, interesting. Sean, you graduated high school in 1902, was it?
Yep, somewhere around there. Yeah, if I remember correctly.
He had to learn all 48 states.
That's good. That's really good.
Assholes. but then in May, December, Natalie Portman is playing an actress, a famous television actress who is about to play the Julianne Moore character in a TV movie.
Interesting.
And so she has they've worked out an agreement that Natalie Portman's character is going to come and shadow the woman to kind of get a sense of their backstory and as much as she can. And Julianne Moore's character is still married to the guy. And they've been married for 20 something years. They have a family together.
Wow.
And it's a lot of like the town where they live theoretically accepts them, but do they really? And then what is Natalie Portman's true motivation? Is she really just shadowing to learn more about the film, or does she have some deeper meanings for why she wants to get involved? But Todd Haynes has obviously worked with Julianne Moore a number of different times. She's terrific in it. She's doing an interesting character choice to play this woman who has been kind of like a tabloid sensation forever. And Natalie Portman, when Natalie Portman can zero in on this kind of very cerebral, but also like a tense to the point of being uncomfortable, like she's kind of like an overachiever. A little Black Swan-ish. I don't want to just automatically go to Black Swan, but like she's so uber focused on getting the character correct. And their dynamic is terrific. I don't think so. But it's definitely it's based on stories that I have seen.
Sure.
So this Mary Kay Letourneau character, I don't remember what year that was. It was in the 90s, I want to say. But that was an actual story of a real woman who had an affair with one of her students. And I mean, I take notice to that just because Michelle's a teacher, and Michelle was horrified to hear about anything like this. Any human would be horrified, but like, you know, a teacher-student relationship is bizarro. So,
which is also why, and again, this is not a teacher-student relationship, but that's why it's what makes Priscilla so interesting in terms of, because he was 24 and she was 14.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested to see how it's explored in this film, because the way Sofia Coppola deals with it, I mean, again, very different circumstances, but still, you know, an older person and a younger person. So I'm very fascinated. But that's a really interesting story to have. Yeah. So I want to see that, actually.
And so for those two specifically, their performances are great. But that film pales in comparison to Poor Things, which I saw immediately after. It actually had to run from one to the other. And
you guys, Yorgos Lanthimos.
Yeah. Was this your favorite of the festival?
It was actually. And
with a U.
I'm trying to figure out how to get Killing of the Sacred Deer in there. You're right. I don't love Yorgos's films up to this point. He just bounces off me for some reason. Like his.
You know, like the favorite?
No, I didn't really care for it.
Oh, Favor was extraordinary.
Yeah, I don't know. Really? Something about his storytelling just has not connected with me up until this point. But I really, really got into this movie. It's, you know, as bizarre as his other films, there's a hook to it that I don't even want to tell you guys. But essentially, it's a Frankenstein story where Willem Dafoe's character has created Emma Stone's character, and that's all I kind of want to say. Emma Stone.
I don't want to know anything. I know nothing
that's basically
about it except
all
for
I know.
It's insane.
That's all you know. I will stop. But what I will say is that Emma Stone is remarkable. I legitimately think that she's a front runner in the actress category. Jake was immediately asking me, like, even more so than Lily Gladstone, who, you know, is campaigning in lead. we'll probably have this conversation a number of different times of whether she should be lead or supporting. I agree on the lead for her.
Yeah, especially I saw Killers again. I wanted to mention this real fast. I saw it again last weekend or last Thursday. So right before the first episode came out, pacing definitely felt different on the second viewing.
Did it?
I thought it moved faster on the second viewing. So I wanted to say that because it hit different the second time. I still am at my same rating and same thoughts of the film, but I did find the pacing too, and the FBI stuff actually to be different feeling than it was. But I think Lily's lead in that film. She's the heart and soul of that movie, and every single scene relies on the reaction of her to.
I can see that
a tragic event. So I do believe that she. Now I haven't seen Emma Stone's performance in Poor Things, and I'm sure it's amazing. But I do understand the leading campaign. Jake, don't you? I mean, like, I feel like she's the lead in that movie.
But let me ask you, in regards to Emma Stone's Oscar, I guess enough time has passed since La La Land, but do you think the recency of, like, well, it's been, was it less than 10 years since we gave her best act, you know? And look, I mean, we're, my favorite actor is an actor who received a best actor
back to back.
Back to back. Sure. But I feel like that doesn't really happen as much.
What were the back to back movies?
Philadelphia and Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
Did he not win for Private Ryan?
No.
Wow. No. Was he nominated?
Yeah,
sure.
He was nominated. Yeah. He should have won for Castaway, but that's different. That's a different podcast.
Yes.
I do agree with that.
Yeah. Yes. So to answer your question about Emma Stone, I honestly believe that she is so good in this that people won't mind giving her a second Oscar. And I also believe that maybe I'm overstating how much I like Emma Stone. I kind of feel like the Academy wouldn't mind if she's a two-time winner.
Everyone likes Emma Stone.
But not even like, I think she's that talented. You know, I legitimately think her range is phenomenal. Yeah. And if you said two-time Academy Award winner Emma Stone, people would be like, that kind of makes sense.
I mean, we kind of forget that, like, those things happen, you know, within a very short amount of time. Jane Fonda won within a short amount of time. De Niro won two Oscars, you know, within a short amount of time. You know, Nicholson has one in the 70s, 80s and 90s.
Sure. Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, these things do happen, but I think we forget about them because we just look back at, you know, just as it being sort of history.
But it's also she's doing something in this she's never done before. And so I could see people, I could see Academy members rewarding her because it's such a different performance than what she gave for La La Land, which won also.
And Lewis's films really do well at the Oscars. Olivia Colman beat Glenn Close.
I do want to ask, because I think, you know, there tends to be one race every year that, like, really excites me. We're like, oh my God, like, all the nominees. And at one, actress is absolutely one of them. But another one that I think is going to be really crazy cool is supporting actor.
Yeah.
And obviously, Downey. You know, you've got everything from Downey. I still say you don't sleep on De Niro. Like, De Niro showed that he's still, like, just one of the all-time greats. Then you've got Gosling. And then I know I've heard a lot of people talk about I heard a lot of people from May December, the man who plays, obviously, the former seventh grader, now a grown man. I've heard he is phenomenal. And then I've heard, in terms of Poor Things, a lot of talk between Ruffalo and Willem Dafoe. And the reason I bring up Willem Dafoe is, one, I just really want to live in a world where Willem Dafoe has an Oscar. And the supporting categories, not to say that he doesn't deserve it, but the supporting categories tend to be the ones that I feel like a lot of times actors win the quote unquote career Oscar. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if there were more so than Downey, because I know a lot of people say, well, Downey has the overdue narrative. To me, Dafoe has the overdue narrative way leaps and bounds over Downey. So I'm curious as to whether or not you think Dafoe is in a position to maybe sweep in and be a sleeper, a contender in the supporting actor category.
Mm-hmm. I will say this without giving away much of anything. Ruffalo has the splashier part.
Mm-hmm.
And I can completely understand why people will nominate him because of the things that he's asked to do. I liked Dafoe a lot better in the film.
Oh, wow.
He's a more interesting character. There's things about him that you're going to be questioning.
He's like the Dr. Frankenstein, right?
Yes, without a doubt. But it's even like, that's the very surface of this character. There's a lot more going on with him.
Why does this character give me Lighthouse vibes?
It's his speech pattern. he has a little bit of that weird speech pattern. It's hard. You'll see it. You'll see it when you, okay, when you see a lot more of it in the movie. I can see why you're getting that. That
it's the images of his face that kind of gave me that vibe. Yeah.
Yes, they are. It's also terrific makeup on his face. I could honestly see both of them getting nominated and they both just sort of take focus away from each other. But before we get out of that category, when rewatching Oppenheimer with Kevin sitting in that theater, because I'd seen it twice, but back when it opened, Downey's fucking unbelievably good. Yeah. Like, he is incredibly good.
And we didn't even get to his third act.
I know. Like, every scene he gets is like a meal, and it just feels like he's... I don't see how he doesn't win.
That's a cool story. After X amount of years on top of the box office and being sort of the biggest star and then getting like a great role and winning, that's a cool story.
If they put the man who moved the earth in his Oscar clip, I'm going to freak out.
You're going to freak out anyway,
Kevin. That is his big scene, though. That's his big dialogue scene. He says, "The man who moved the earth."
I hope it's when Einstein walks past him and blows him off. Oh. And he just looks horrified.
What a moment.
One of the great thing I got to do in Savannah that I just want to give a quick shout out to is Pete Sohn, who's the director of Elemental. They brought that down there. There's an animation panel that they were doing as part of the Savannah College of Art and Design Festival. And I mentioned that Spider-Verse was there. They also did a screening of Elemental. This was on Monday afternoon at 2 p.m. It was opposite a screening of Barbie, which the students were, I can tell you, over the moon about. There was people dressed in pink all over the place, and I knew Barbie was going to draw incredibly well. But I was able to do, asked to do the moderation for the Q&A after the Elemental screening. And so I ducked into the theater on my way over to meet Pete in the green room, and it was packed. And I was so happy because it's a movie that's on streaming right now. You can get on Disney Plus. It had been in theaters, but to see people come out and support that movie at the festival was really important to me, meant a lot to me. And just telling the story of that movie, which, you know, it got off to what is historically the lowest opening weekend in Pixar history. And then it just didn't disappear. You know, it held its legs. It would drop where you'd see a normal movie over the summertime go down like 50-60%, it would drop like 12%. Yeah. Or in some of the weeks, the longer it went, it actually went up. You know, it gained an audience, which is incredible. And it ended up topping out. This was pretty funny because I had all these statistics written down and I was reading them off at the beginning of the Q&A. And I was like, it made it to $488 million worldwide. And Pete's like $493. And I was like, oh, I'm very sorry. Very sorry. So I got to meet him backstage in the green room. And what I really was impressed by is that he remembered us from from when we went out to Pixar and immediately came over and was like, oh, my God, I loved talking with you and Jake and Kevin. And he was asking a ton of questions about Real Blend and how we record and who we've spoken to recently, and was still gushing about, you know, how much he enjoyed the interview that we did and the format of the show. And then talking to him on the stage was just so great because he got really candid about the roller coaster ride that he's been on emotionally with this film, how when it came out and it didn't get incredible reviews and it was met with that box office reaction that they really at the studio thought that they were getting a hit, you know, that this was gonna break through to the audience, and then they were shocked, you know, when it didn't connect. And he really started to personally doubt himself. And then as it caught on and found its audience, and the one thing that he said, which I thought was unbelievable, was he goes, you hear the term word of mouth, but he goes, I've never really had a personal experience with it. He goes, but that's the only way to describe how this movie found its audience. You know, it was audience members connecting with the story and connecting with the material and connecting with the characters, and then turning around and saying to other audience members, you have to go see this in the theater, go. And the numbers back that up, and it found its audience. And when it went to Disney Plus in the first 5 days on Disney Plus, it allegedly did 26 million views and was the highest gross or the most viewed film on the platform for its first 5 days. And again, these are streaming numbers, so we have to take Disney's, you know, on faith essentially. But still, I'm thrilled that all of this was going on with Pete, and he's just an incredibly nice guy who deserves all the success. The minute we finished our Q&A, a girl who had done a portrait of Wade, the character from Elemental, came running up, and Pete was just blown away by this. And he jumped off the stage and took a picture with her. And that immediately went on his socials. And so that's why I love that festival so much, because it has the college element attached to it. And these students are just so hungry for the opportunity to meet these artists who they are, you know, trying to follow in their footsteps, essentially, and glean any kind of knowledge that they can about their individual journeys. So to hear Pete talk about how to break into animation, you know, what they look for at Pixar from up and coming artists, the struggles that he went through, and then for him to really say to these people, you know, it's opening weekend. I'm living proof that opening weekend doesn't necessarily matter as much as people say that it is. You know, you have to believe in your story. You have to believe in your characters. You have to believe in your art. For this movie in particular, there was a time in the middle of production when they scrapped the story that they had, and he just had to throw it out because of all the different test screenings that they were holding at Pixar and all the notes he was getting back from the Pixar animators saying, like, hey, man, if we're just being candidly honest, this doesn't work. This doesn't work. You know, I feel different about this. And he had to accept all that and take it all in and then just chuck it and start over. And so for him to give that message to the students of like how valuable notes are, and don't be afraid if something's not hitting the way that you want it to hit, to just, you know, start over, you know, go back to the roots, go back to what you think it's supposed to be. I thought it was a really valuable conversation. And I really appreciated getting a chance to catch up with him again. So
that's so cool.
I'm going to plug our initial interview with Pete, which the three of us got to do at Pixar, which was phenomenal. And I want to promote Elemental again. If you haven't given Elemental a shot, if you know, kind of think that Pixar has become a factory for sequels, you know, and Toy Story 4, and they've got Inside Out 2 coming up. To me, it's a tremendous original story. It's a love story. It's got great characters. The visuals for it, to go in and see him, see how they did Ember again, and to see how they did Wade, you know, this fire character and this water character and the whole of Elemental City. I'm a huge fan of that movie. So I'm really glad I got a chance to catch back up with it. So I just wanted to tell you guys about that. Okay.
He's welcome on the show anytime.
Of course, and I think he would love to come back on, to be honest with you. He was really happy to talk about it. It is Halloween spooky season, and we've a horror aficionado here on the show, but we're all going to go around the horn, and we're going to say, you can only put one film on, one film for spooky season. What are you putting on, Jake Hamilton?
Mine is an incredibly cliche answer, but just because of its ties to Illinois and the suburbs of Illinois and what is supposed to be right outside Chicago, I've got to go with Halloween. Even though it's shot in Los Angeles, the whole concept of Haddonfield, Illinois, is that it's supposed to be the street that you grew up on. It's supposed to be the horror of this thing that happens is that it could happen two blocks over. And you know, you go out into, again, even though they didn't shoot it in Chicago, you go to Lincoln Park, you go to, you know, you don't even have to get outside Chicago, and you see a street that has the kind of shrubbery that Michael was just like, you know, just leaning out of, you know, and I just feel, you know, everything about that movie feels like fall. It just feels like that crispness, you know, it feels like the leaves changing. And to me, that's because there are so many great horror movies that I save for a little bit later in the year. You know, I always talk about how, you know, I don't watch The Thing or The Shining until I know that it's going to be like downpouring snow in Chicago. And I kind of sort of, so my fall enter into fall is got to be Halloween. Though, you know, it's so funny. I am working on a story with my station now about all of the great horror movies that were filmed in Chicago. And there were, like, in my deep dive, it really made me realize, even though, you know, I'm counting Halloween as a Chicago horror film, even though they didn't shoot it here. Child's Play was shot about, you know, a half mile from my apartment. Both the 90s Candyman and the most recent Candyman was about Cabrini Green, which was a Chicago project that was, you know, very prominent in Chicago in the 90s. And there's been that the area has been super gentrified since then. And that's really what the new Candyman was all about. And even like the remake of A Nightmare on Elm Street was filmed in Chicago. So, like, you know, the fact that the city of Chicago can call itself home to Freddy, Chucky, Candyman, and Michael is pretty incredible. So that's a long way of saying, to me, like, you can't get through it, because I tend to shake it up, but I can't get through this season without putting on John Carpenter's 1978 masterpiece, which turns 45 years old tomorrow, which depending on when you listen to this, it's already passed. You missed it. It turns 45 tomorrow, and it's just such an incredible, perfect, seamless film. I love it. I love it so much.
Kevin, you get one opportunity to scare an audience. What are you putting on?
Those are two different questions.
It's spooky season and you can only put one film on. What are you putting on?
Probably Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah. Oh, just because I love Sleepy Hollow.
It's just the vibe of that film.
I was going to say that's a good vibe film.
Yeah.
And it just kind of has a specific vibe to it, but also like Colleen Atwood's costume design and obviously Tim Burton. And it's just one of those films. Do you guys know, a little trivia question, who shot Sleepy Hollow? Go look it up.
Is it Chivo?
It was Chivo.
Yeah, I knew that.
Manuel Lubezki, who shot Children of Men and obviously Gravity and a bunch of stuff. But Sleepy Hollow, there's something about that film. That or Trick or Treat. Those are like the two that I kind of...
I was thinking Trick or Treat too. I love Trick or Treat.
Mike Doherty. Yeah. And I think, but Sleepy Hollow to me is just the vibe. Just the way it's shot, the tone of it. There's humor and absurd violence, but it's also scary. And Christopher Walken, I had a chance to interview Colleen Atwood the other day, actually, weirdly enough. I never talked to her before. She did the costume design for Pain Hustlers, I think, the David Yates film. And she was talking about Sleepy Hollow and how they had to develop that costume for Christopher Walken, because remember, his head is below. So there's like a whole thing.
I thought Ray Park was the actual Headless Horseman. I can't imagine they would get that Walken would do the part.
I think there are some scenes where Walken is in the suit, though, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, when he's headless?
Misremembering it.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, I'm wrong.
I know some portions, and because particularly that time, that period of the late 90s.
Because danced, remember? He was like, no.
Yeah. Well, regardless of Christopher Walken, the costume they had to create for that character, for the person to be in a suit with no head, whether it was Walken or Park. Sure. Was it Park? Ray Park?
Ray Park, yeah.
Yeah, so either way, that film is my
This is a game we haven't played in a while, where like, when the aliens come to Earth, what two movies do you show? But like, I think you can make it for Tim Burton.
I almost put that game together today.
Really?
I thought of that. I was like, oh, that's great.
You could make a really solid case for Sleepy Hollow being a Tim Burton choice, because it's so quintessential. Like, if you need to try to explain to someone what a Tim Burton movie is, I think you either point to Sleepy Hollow or you point to Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah,
I would agree.
And I'd rather watch Hollow, I think.
Oh, I would. Yeah,
that is amazing.
I would 100% absolutely. I watched that. Too. Yeah, it's a great movie.
My recommendation is maybe a little bit unconventional, but Jake mentioned it the other day in the text thread, and so that I put it on, and it's the Friday the 13th remake. Is it 2009?
Yeah, something like that.
Because I love Jason.
Yeah.
But Jason has his issues as a creeper, essentially.
When people think of Jason, I think they're thinking of an amalgamation. The Friday the 13th movies. I think people forget.
That's why the line in Scream is so brilliant. Yes. Because if you ask someone who the killer is.
Yeah.
Like, you're 100% right. Like, we have a vision of who Jason is.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The first 30 minutes.
If you go back and
rewatch
those, they're not great. They're not great.
I love them. I love
the first one's really.
I love Kevin Bacon's in that. And the arrow through the throat. No, I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt you. The reason I bring that up is because Jason is such an interesting. I was telling you the other day that I was at a Spirit Halloween or something like that with my girlfriend, and she knows I love all the 80s slasher stuff, and she's like, oh, look at that cool poster, and it was the original Friday the 13th logo from 1980, and then Jason in the hockey mask, and I went, nope, because, and she's like, why? I was like, because Jason's not the killer in Friday the 13th, and he doesn't get the hockey mask part 3 and part 2. He has this little sack with a hole through the eye, and she's like, oh my god, who am I dating?
Yeah,
isn't part 2 kind of like, doesn't it pick up like in the hospital? Isn't or is that Halloween?
That's Halloween. Now that's Halloween part 2.
Is Jason not the killer in the second Friday the 13th?
He is.
But he doesn't get the hockey mask till part 3.
Oh, yes. Really?
He wears like a burlap, not a burlap. So yeah, like maybe like a burlap sack with like a hole cut through the eye.
Mm-hmm. Like Scarecrow kind of thing?
Yeah, and then it's not until part three. So the first 40 minutes of the remake are kind of cliff notes of 1 through 3.
It's a little more brown paper bag looking than Scarecrow.
Yeah.
That's fair.
But it is a burlap sack.
But the Friday 13th remake does what you want an updated version to do, in that it amplifies Jason.
Yeah.
And the first 30 minutes of it are a terrific sample.
It's a great little mini film for Jason.
Yes. And then, but then even beyond that, the kills throughout it are creative. They're really creative. And the girl who's swimming in the water through the pier, and then she gets lifted back up and hits the top of the pier.
I got to take this opportunity to mention Freddy vs. Jason, because that film, I still love watching that movie.
It's a
fun one, just to see those two fight. I also thought the ending of that was brilliant. Like, I know that we had to choose a winner, and I think that Jason did win the fight. Obviously, he walks away with a spoiler alert, Freddy's head. But dude,
I'm still waiting for them to finish the trilogy with Alien versus Predator versus Freddy versus Jason.
Did I tell you guys the story about I had Bruce Campbell a couple of months ago when Evil Dead came out, and you know they were gonna do Freddy versus Jason versus Ash, I'd asked him what happened to it, and he said that the two studios were each so protective of their monster that, very much like how we complain about the action stars of today not willing to take in punches, that like they would only allow their characters to take so many punches or be hurt so much. And Bruce Campbell was really the only one that's willing to be like, well, like Ash can get beat up, like that's fine. So he was like, well, this is not going to be fair. Like, my character is going to get his ass kicked and I can only hit Freddy and Jason so many times. Like, what's the point of doing it? Then there's no point. Like, that I'm basically like going to be like their whipping boy.
I wouldn't mind a more Army of Darkness take where Ash is kind of the slapsticky getting his ass kicked by two. Like I would take that. That would be kind of fun. But I imagine that's not what they were going for.
Sean, I'm so excited with your answer. So I keep interrupting you.
Well, that's it. That's all I had. I mean, I think that I'm proud of what it did.
Yeah.
It's not great by any stretch.
No, it's not. But I feel like this is the ultimate sign of, you know, it was a dark and rainy day on a Saturday a couple of weekends back. And so my girlfriend and I were decorating the inside of her house for Halloween. And so we said, OK, let's make a fun day of it. And we just kept putting on, you know, horror movies. HBO Max has a great collection of horror movies.
That's where I watched it.
And so we just kept putting them on. But I kept putting on ones that I didn't think she would be interested in, because my girlfriend doesn't particularly like the gory stuff. And we found ourselves not doing that much work because we kept sitting down watching. And one of the things that we sat down and watched, because I said, okay, this is actually really good, is that it takes about 35 minutes before the title card for the Friday the 13th remake shows up.
Right.
And that shot right before it shows up of him just sprinting and swinging his machete over is fantastic. It's so good.
I remember watching that in I think I was in high school and that came out. It had to be. And it came out on Friday the 13th. I remember watching it.
Yeah.
Getting through the first like three or four kills and going, what's left? Like, I didn't know that was going to be. I was like, what's left in this movie? How are they? What's happening?
Because it sums like up the whole thing with his mom, like in the first 10 minutes. Minutes. Yeah. Can I give one more horror movie shout out really quick? Because I always love to shout out the 2003 Marcus Nespel remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
So good.
Which I know it is, for a lot of people, it is blasphemy to hail a remake. And look, Toby Hooper's
Michael Bay.
Yeah, Michael Bay. Toby Hooper's original is a stone cold masterpiece. Like, you can never top the rawness of Leatherface in that original.
I can't watch that movie. I can't watch it. It's too disturbing.
Oh, I love it. It's too disturbing. I love it so much. But the remake, 20 years old this year, is one of my favorite horror films of all time. It is so well done. It is so beautifully shot. I know it sounds weird to say like Texas Chainsaw remake, but it's the same cinematographer from the original film. It's beautifully, gorgeously shot. They treat Leatherface great. It's just a really, really... And there is one shot in that film that is probably one of my top 10 favorite horror movie shots ever. And it is a shot that goes through a young girl's head And then out through the back of a van window and then down like into a valley, all one shot. It's Ooh. Kevin, you know what I'm talking about.
What's the matter with you?
That's a really good movie.
It's a great movie. Well, great movie.
Since Jake added one more, I'm going to add one more. if you haven't seen The Descent.
Oh, sure. Dude. Yes.
One of my favorite horror films of all time. Make sure you seek out the UK version, yes, not the American version, because they changed the ending in the American version.
I literally was about to put it on for Adrian, and then I went, oh, yeah, no, this is the American version. We can't do that. Yeah. But you can't find the UK version. This is a testament to
Kevin.
This is right behind Kevin. Physical copies of things. Keep your physical copies of things, because you can't find the UK version anywhere.
And that movie's a masterclass in claustrophobic.
Oh, yes. It's the closest our generation will get to the first Alien.
Brilliant.
Ooh, I don't like claustrophobia.
Is that Neil Marshall? Who directed Blomkamp? That movie?
No,
someone. I'll double check it. Anyways.
Please do. All right. So what one film would you guys put on?
Or you could cheat like us and name like 18 different movies.
For spooky season. Head to the comments in our YouTube channel. While you're down there, please give us a like and a subscribe. We are growing the channel little by little. Tell friends who love movies to come over and watch Real Blend for our very fun interviews and fun conversations like this. In the meantime, we will be back with another full episode next week. You can follow us during the week at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach. And the show is at Real Blend. Kevin, I imagine you're going to have a lot of fun this week with the Speaker of the House debate still going on. Your mentions are probably in a lot of hot water.
It's a lot of opportunities to mention Oppenheimer, though. Like someone the other day was telling me, like, why did you take so long to vote no on something? I was like, well, I was watching Oppenheimer 8 times. I haven't been in the Capitol to make decisions.
I like when you take a word from their thing and like,
yeah,
did you mean Mean Girls with Tina Fey and Lindsay Lohan? Someone told me
I was doing a really bad job once, and I think I wrote back like this paragraph long thing about Steve Jobs and how Danny Boyle shot 16mm, 35mm, and digital. And I said, listen, if you mention Jobs, I have to mention that. And like, it was like this paragraph long thing of like,
but my favorite, like, what I really hope is that there are people that even after you respond that way, don't realize that you're not, and they just think that it's the Speaker of the House responding about Steve Jobs. And
you're probably getting him votes. You're getting him votes with your, he's got great taste in movies.
That actually happened. Someone responded back. I think I said something about like watching, it was like some movie I'd seen multiple times, and the person was like, exactly, you're not doing your job. I'm like, wait, you know who's tweeted me multiple times is Deborah Messing.
I said that. Didn't I tell you guys? Deborah Messing.
I always respond to her and say, I love you and Along Came Polly. I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
That's great.
It's because she was for scuba.
We'll be back next week.
Until then, is so good in that.
This might be the last time that we can say,
Pay your artists.
Pay your actors, please. We want to get
definitely
back to
pay your actors and artists.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.